A very good morning to everyone present here, and of course, thank you for you know, being here and listening to my presentation. I'm usually very loud, so I don't know if this is going to hurt your ears. I would like to take this opportunity to thank my mentors, Dr. Stephen Nagy, Dr. Christine Nagy, and Elizabeth Mohan. This was a project that I first participated in when I enrolled into the master's program of in public health. So some introduction about sexual assault on campuses. Sexual assault is the most underreported violent crime in the United States. Approximately 60% of the crimes are not reported. 60% of crimes are not reported, and of the 40% that are reported, only 6% of perpetrators, they ever serve a day in jail. In other words, 15 out of 16 perpetrators walk free. One in six women have been victimized. This is data until 2005, and one in 33 men have been victimized. It was found that college-age women are about four times more likely to be sexually assaulted. We developed a questionnaire called the Interpersonal and Sexual Assault Survey, which was based on the social ecology model, and it had 195 questions on it. Out of the many research questions asked, the one that I was interested in was to compare victims and non-victims of sexual assault on traits that may identify targets for intervention. So we seek the help of information technology. They provided us with a random stratified sample of 8,000 student emails, and we had 1,548 respondents. The survey was distributed by Student Voice, and it was available for a three-week period. Students were contacted through email to take part in the online survey, and they were sent weekly reminders. Students who completed the survey were eligible to be included in a drawing for one of 10 prizes. There was an Apple iPhone to give away, a Nintendo Wii, and $100 gift cards for academic use. This was a simple, straightforward study, so we used chi-square analysis. So we found that 5% of students on campus reported that they were victimized. This means that 1,000 students, at least 1,000 students on campus reported being sexually assaulted. We had 6.7% of females and 1.3% of males who reported being victimized. So when we looked at the demographic traits, we found that being female, white, single and living off campus were risk factors for being victimized. And we found that practicing religion more than 1 to 2 times a week served as a protective factor against victimization. In fact, risk of female respondents who practice religion less than 1 to 2 times per week were almost at double the risk of than the students who practice religion 1 to 2 times a week. Among non-victims, those that have been stalked or received unwanted attention, we had 17.6% females who said that they have been stalked or receive unwanted attention, and 10.6% males who reported the same. And in spite of these numbers, only 6% of the students on campus feel that sexual violence is a concern among college students. So we asked the students, we asked the respondents, what do you think we should do? What are your recommendations? This is what they said. Advertise campus resources for intimate partner violence, invite guest speakers on violence in relationships, skill building sessions for women and men together. Among non-victims and victims, these were the common top three approaches. Victims also recommended developing a strategic plan to addressing violence in relationships, and skill building sessions for men only received the least number of votes. So, summarizing, characteristics that place them at a higher risk are living off campus, being white, single, and of course being females. Protective factors were rare. Regular religious practice was protective. Victims and non-victims recommend the following approaches: advertising campus resources, having guest speakers to talk on the topic, to conduct peer-to-peer discussions, skill-building sessions for both men and women together. Victims also recommended developing a strategic plan to address violence in relationships. Sexual assault, based on the results of our findings, we imply the following. sexual assault protection of students must involve on and off-campus prevention strategies. In our sample, Caucasian women were at greater risk, and therefore, ethnic-specific prevention messages seem warranted. Single women are primary targets for prevention messages, and religious practice identifies attributes of women that may assist in developing more effective programs. Awareness about sexual assault prevention should be increased in the form of advertisements on campus. Annual skill building sessions should be mandatory for all students, especially in the freshman year. Guest speakers should be invited to talk on the topic. There was a study conducted on the campus of a Northeastern university, and there was a freshman group selected in 2003, and you know, when they just entered college in September 2003, they were, you know, asked to participate in a 90-minute dramatic presentation called Sex Signals. And after, I think in October, they were also asked to, you know, participate in a two-hour education workshop. And in the sophomore year, they were asked to, you know, fill out an online survey, and it was they were asked whether, you know, it was they were asked whether they have been victimized in those 2 years. And these results were compared with the freshman year of the previous, of not 2003, but 2002, when it was found that when they were exposed to these education programs and these discussions, the rates of victimization was much lower than the previous year. A strategic plan to prevent sexual assault should be in place on every campus. The university that I come from, we do have a strategic plan. Limitations, this was a self-report sample. It must be understood that many abused victims will not volunteer. It is likely that rates are actually higher. Some identifiers may actually represent safer environments rather than personality traits. By this we mean, students practicing more religious activities, they seem to be, you know, protective against victimization. So maybe by safer environment, we mean that, you know, maybe they're attending, church and things like that. So probably that is safer than, you know, them actually practicing religion more. A sample was biased towards Caucasians and maybe misrepresentative of other ethnic groups. These are the recent federal laws on campus crime. We have the Clery Act of 1990, which was initiated by the parents of a woman who was sexually assaulted and killed in her dormitory. And this act requires all universities nationwide to report crime statistics online on the national websites. These are the sexual offense policies at Western Kentucky University. And based on the results of the study, which was conducted in 2007, we have a lot of programs which are in place. We have the master plan, which is a part of the new student orientation, and we educate them and create awareness about sexual violence on campus. We also discuss this in the university experience classes. There's something called as the rape aggression defense classes, which is exclusively for females, and we teach them, you know, self-defense techniques. And once they enroll in this program, they have a lifetime return policy. They can, you know, even if they graduate, they can come back and renew their skills. We have the student escort services. You know, if a student is feeling uncomfortable or threatened at odd hours, they can, you know, always give a call to the student escort services and they will make sure to get them home. We had the Sexual Assault Awareness Month in March, and Hope Harbor, a life center, health services, and all these organizations came together and they created and, you know, spread a lot of awareness messages on campus. We also have the Green Dot program, which is implemented by Elizabeth Mohan, who is the coordinator of Sexual Assault Counseling Center on campus. And this program is being implemented around South Central Kentucky, and it promotes and encourages people to, you know, develop intolerance to rape, domestic violence, stalking, and things like that. These are my references, and thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to thank all of our presenters for sticking to the time and allowing us to get through everybody's presentations and some time for questions and answers. So are there questions? Yes. Good Samaritan policies?
Yes. If you were just a little louder. Oh, Good Samaritan policies Yeah, I think probably maybe the person who's, you know, under the influence of alcohol or other people who do the reporting, they're, if they call the police, then they can't help but down with the sanction that you've got at the university, that they're given a chance to.
Yeah, WVU has no tolerance to sexual assault policy, and anybody who hears about, you know, incidents like that, or people's want incidents like that, it's, you know, encouraged to report for this, encouraged to report anybody, they need to send an email to the president of the university and the community. Did I answer your question?
Are you talking about alcohol use?
Yeah, alcohol use.
Yeah, we just implemented that within the past year. So we moved from to a point system, so the student would not receive points if they assisted another student. Right. Gallaudet has that. Yeah.
Our HBC campuses do not, but there are two of them who are in the process of revising the policy for the universities to include exactly that. So, and also there's a version of the same policy that they're going to include more around sexual violence, meaning if there's sexual violence or violence in the dorm hall, that also that student who has told will not be brought in face to face with the student. So it's more of a process that's happening dorm hall by dorm hall. So they're not instituted yet, but there are two universities that are doing it.
Yes.
Your first question was about correct. So 1 in 2 experience sexual assault compared with other hearing college students, which is 1 in 4. What the research found.
But campus.
On campus, yeah. Those results were on campus.
Yes, I know, but they reflected the past, right? Their past experiences and whatever.
Oh, you mean currently as a current college student?
Yes.
It was lifetime, yes. It was not as a college student.
Okay.
No.
Not necessarily from your study, but
correct.
Is there a high incidence of sexual assault on that campus?
Yes, there is. As far as during their college years, yes. That has not been indicated within that research, but as far as working with campus police and judicial affairs and things like that on campus, I'm also directing the health and wellness programs on campus, so I'm intimately involved in that process, and there are a large number of students that either come to see me or report. Of course, as we all know, sexual assault is not a highly reported area, but yes, reported. I implemented an anonymous reporting process on campus about 6 years ago, and there are a large number of students that come forward to anonymously report. However, through hearsay, there are a large number that don't come forward to even anonymously report. Yes, and then deaf schools, which is residential schools. I did not follow up on that research, but as far as the limited research that is done in deaf schools, as far as I was saying, the hidden curriculum, not being able to communicate with their sexual partners, a lot of that does occur through the experimentation process in deaf schools. Sexual assault does occur. As far as there's also dorm staff have been found to commit a lot of sexual abuse within deaf schools. So
previous researchers have found that and categorized that as child sexual abuse, not as sexual assault. So that's what a lot of the research that's been done regarding sexual assault in the deaf community is childhood sexual abuse and not as adult sexual assault.
Yes.
It was the eighth grade reading level.
So you used the eighth grade?
Yes. As far as the scales that I used, I did change the terminology and vocabulary a great deal when I went through the readability with my students, the deaf college students, to lower the reading level to the eighth grade, but I was not able to lower any lower than that based on the scales that I was using in order to get the information that I needed.
Over here.
Actually, our project does address same-sex violence for women and men, but because we are funded through the Office of Women's Health, that's not a bulk of our focus. But because there is a concern that's been expressed by our campuses of same-sex violence and the lack of training to handle same-sex violence in an appropriate gender-specific way, we have developed a curriculum and a protocol with each institution based on how they do want to address that. But we don't usually promote that in our project. Not because we don't want to, but just because the focus is women, but we recognize that if we're going to be on the college campus, we can't neglect same-sex relationships, let alone male-to-male same-sex relationships, because they're still students and the policies still have to apply.
My research did not focus on offenders or perpetrators, it only focused on the survivors. So we didn't differentiate between same-sex or different-sex survivors.
Okay. Right. Yes?
My question goes to Amelia. You spoke about the denim day on campus and how so many people were involved, especially at one of the universities. But I was wondering if there's any data gathered to prove that the awareness had helped
yes.
increase the amount of sexual
we did. We did. We did pre and post. What we did is the first week of National Sexual Assault Month, we actually did a pre and post assessment around bystander interventions, looking at the five stages of change. We did do that on each of the campuses. That's one of the limited challenges. Our project was not a grant. We actually have been funded grant money by the office that did a small pilot project, which was a business contract. So it was not a grant, and those kind of have different research funding mechanisms. The Office of Women's Health is not focused on research. Research can come out of it, but it's really focused on education and programming. So we did do that. That did vary based on colleges. I didn't outline for you, but all of the eight colleges, some of them are really large. Some of them are very tiny. One of the schools only has like 1,000 students. So we did look at that. We did see an increase on the larger middle to size campuses. As far as it relates to sexual assault prevention and also response, meaning do students know their resources on campus as a follow-up to that. We did see where students moved from pre-contemplation to contemplation or even all the way for women's groups, particularly sororities, the maintenance stage. So we were able to do that. I think the challenge with the evaluation is when we were funded to do three schools, the need was so great, we ended up doing eight schools with different sizes and in different regions. So our big challenge with evaluation is to do as many comparisons as we can beyond just the five stages of change. So cross your fingers, hopefully we'll have a paper out of that. My evaluator actually was in here, but she left. So I was hoping she would stay at the end because she's actually been playing with this data over the last 30 days. So. And I will say, sexual assault has not been heavily addressed on college campuses, particularly historically by college campuses, unless it's harassment or sexual assault student to faculty. But it has not been addressed extensively, let alone awareness student to student. So that's really been a grassroots effort where we've documented breaking through with at least five of the most popular HBCUs. So. Hope that kind of answers your question.
In the back?
Yes, I was wondering how much a campus college venue contributes to unwanted sexual experiences. And one of the phenomena we see on college campuses now is the hooking
they don't document, they don't, well, at least on HBCU campuses, it's not defined as hooking up.
What the hell are they doing about that?
Hooking up is...
I know what it is, but I don't really sure what I'm talking about.
You can go ahead, because we don't define it as hooking up. So it is hooking up, but it's not, the lingo is not discussed hooking up. So if you guys use hooking up...
No, okay, informally.
Hooking up more or less is one-time sexual acts continuously with different people. So it's not a committed mutual relationship. But I think that talks about gender, social norms, and cultural norms as it relates to the definition of in the context of a relationship. And again, speaking not on behalf of the colleges, but on behalf of the project, when you look at the definition of hooking up, in my opinion, the same thing about hooking up is happening on historical college campuses. However, it's not defined as hooking up because it is seen from the female's perspective. From a man's perspective, it might be hooking up or in same-sex relationships, but from a female heterosexual relationship, if I've hooked up with you one time, and even if we haven't hooked up again in the last 30 days, I could see that as a relationship. I could self-define that as a relationship. And going forward to if that's happened one time, but it hasn't happened again, and again, this is not a story, let's say if the female doesn't date that guy anymore, but she invites him in, there might be an instance where sexual violence can be involved because the invitation before was consented previously, but now it no longer is. So I will say the definition of hooking up is not happening, but the social and constructual pressures of hooking up on a HBCU campus is real because of the gender inequality ratios of men and women. Does that, but we don't really use hooking up.
Over here.
When you talk about the gender piece, gender harassment, so are you talking about, are you referring to the harassment of women? Are you talking about assumed sexuality or non-traditional gender presentation?
Yeah, we actually didn't specify. It was, the question was, have you ever done the following to a male or female in your classroom? And it's not necessarily gender specific, however, it's much more related to sexual harassment. And I just call it gender harassment because it's not bullying. It may be more the indirect forms of bullying because some of it is, you know, the spreading sexual rumors or writing sexual messages on a wall, but it is much more sexual in nature.
And my second question is, how often, because I know that you said in this other research has found that women perpetrate more violence than men in teen dating violence or adolescent violence. What was the difference between men and women, the percentages who watched shock sites and X-rated? So was it a significant difference, or did women do
it
that?
It was actually really similar.
Really?
I didn't find any gender differences with the sites. But it also could be because the way they're defining the shock site. So, you know, it was just a, you know, A, B, C, D, this is a shock site, but we don't know exactly what site they were visiting. So the guys could be visiting these sexually explicit sites. However, there are other shock sites that are not sexually explicit in nature. There's, you know, like hot or not, you rate, you know, the how attractive individuals are. That is considered a shock site. However, it wouldn't really be considered a shock site based on the other ones. So they're very similar, breakdown by gender. But we just don't know the sites.
Yes?
I have a question for you too. On your survey, was that a web survey? And did you do any other, did you do multiple contests to get people to respond?
Yes, we did. So it was a web survey, and they actually completed the web survey over 18 months, and we sent them reminders about a week and then a few days before they were supposed to complete their 6 month, 12 month, and then 18 month follow ups.
And so those were all email reminders.
We were a little sneaky here, is that we had the software on their computers, so we had pop-up reminders. So it may not necessarily have been email. We did do email reminders as well, and then we did birthday cards for individuals, but we had pop-ups come up, say, oh, it's time for your survey for 6 month baseline. So that web software really helped us a lot.
They downloaded that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, once they accepted, it automatically got downloaded.
Well, we sent them a CD-ROM.
Oh, okay.
And then they had to download it from there. And we also gave them technical assistance if there were any issues with the software.
Can I just ask one more question about the email addresses you all were giving? Were they campus stationed email?
No, these kids were 14 to 17 years old. So they were teens, just, you know, random digit dial, national samples.
So you got the parent's permission, and then the parent gives you the kid, get him on the phone, you give him the email,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, please.
That is something for future research. We did not, I did not research offenders or perpetrators. There is so little research just about survivors that I started with that first.
Yes.
From professional staff or as far as
RAs? I mean, and professional staff.
I guess what I was discussing before as far as offenders or perpetrators being the dorm staff were the professional staff. So the hall directors, that type of thing. But as far as how to assist individuals, survivors, before or after? Prevention or?
I'm prevention.
Well, I mean, acquaintance rates is, you know, the highest percentage, 80 to 90%. So a lot of the time, it's someone that the person knows. So it's educating. I think a lot of times students have information and they think it's a stranger going to jump out of the bushes at them, but that's not how it really happens. So education about sexual assault, being acquaintance rape, date rape, that type of thing, talking about that it's going to be someone that you know at a party. Alcohol was mentioned as being involved a lot of the time. So it's talking about those type of issues, consent, talking about what does consent mean, what is sexual assault. I think I didn't have time to cover it, of course, but defining sexual assault and rape, I think a lot of times people don't really understand. As I mentioned, there's acknowledged and unacknowledged sexual assault. So a lot of times in my study, only 20% acknowledged that they experienced it, but they stated that they had experienced sexual behaviors that was categorized as sexual assault, yet they were not self-defining that as experiencing. So defining sexual assault and rape and what that means, and educating students about that, as well as consent. It's not really about protecting themselves, it's about knowing what it means. Of course, how to say no, but the fact that anything but a no is a no. So saying nothing or not saying, not saying yes. So saying no versus not saying anything, that's all a no. If alcohol is involved, you're not legally able to consent. So it's a lot of different things that people really don't know. So, yes, the rape myth, yes, this and that, the sexual communication that I discussed too, but it's a lot based on education as well and what it means, I think. So as an RA, being in touch with whatever office on campus that provides information.
You gotta stay with us, we got a couple more minutes left.
And making sure that the word gets out to students. Because a lot of times when I or my students do presentations on campus, students don't have that information. So the RA can really be a key person providing that information to the people on their floors.
Just really quickly, just a one-liner for us, just to answer your question. RAs not only need just that one-time training, I'm talking about director staff or community staff, the staff members, the adults that aren't students. The students are the RAs, which are the GAs, which are the graduate students. Not only do they need training that's not one time a year, they need to undergo quarterly training, which that's one of the perks of our project. That actually has happened. And also the integration of continuous programming for their floor and their hall and as it relates to not only bystander interventions, but also the follow-up by which you as an RA become witnessed or knowledgeable of a sexual assault or dating violence in your dorm, how you follow up with that moving through the system. One of the students, because our project is student-led, made recommendations last month to the White House, to Vice President Biden and Lynn Rosenthal, the advisor on violence against women, that suggests that all RAs should also go through counseling as it relates to not being a counselor, but being a peer counselor to navigate the student through the campus system because of all the fear, the stigma, and the challenges. And so as far as programming, I think we're doing two, but for that last one that she made the recommendation for, that should be on all campuses. Not to force the student to be a counselor, but that RA has more power on that campus than any other division, department. I think even more power than the police department, because that RA can get that student, and I've seen it done with our projects, can get that student to access those campus services. So,
I think we have time for one last question, if there's one. Yes. Hopefully our presenters will stick around if there are a few more questions, but if you join me in thanking all of them, please. Thanks so much for coming.